Welcome back to the Etched in Stone podcast. We have a special episode for you today. This is the third interview that we conducted with John Smith when we were producing the Etched in Stone audio documentary, The Smiths. And so this episode has never been released before. And in it, John talks about Pat Smith's high school career, his college career, and then also John's early years of coaching. Enjoy it, and we'll see you soon.
Iconic wrestling coach Dan Gable once said, "Pain is nothing compared to what it feels like to quit. Give everything you've got today, for tomorrow may never come." Gable could be describing those whose achievements have earned them the honor of being inducted into the National Wrestling Hall of Fame. Etched in Stone, the stories of wrestling's legends will take you inside the lives of over 200 of the greatest wrestlers in history as they share their never-before-told stories about their trials, tribulations, and triumphs. Competitors, coaches, teammates, and those who knew these athletes best will also weigh in on their accomplishments with their own unique perspectives.
How would you describe Pat as a high school wrestler?
You know, one of those guys that you're going, you got to get him, you know. He's going to have an impact immediately, a four-time national champ. I mean, nobody can see that coming, you know. Just one of those kids that you're like, and you're close to, obviously being his brother, and you know he's got all the right attitude, and he's growing up with his a brother that's reeling off some championships and doing some things, and it's having no effect on his personality, no effect on what he wants to do. It's like the perfect match, like, yes, we want you, Pat, because you're not worried about nothing. You want to win yourself, you know, and not, you know, worrying about trying to live up to, you know, someone. So for that reason, Pat excelled in high school, you know. I mean, really, I say it often, Pat's an overachiever, you know. And he was an overachiever while he wrestled at Oklahoma State, you know. He worked hard. You know, he wasn't he might get pissed off at me, but wasn't the most talented guy. He really didn't have my speed, my flexibility. He was different, you know, and he worked and earned everything that he accomplished.
And when he came in, Bob Dellinger told him, actually at the Hall of Fame there, he's like, "Listen, you're a good kid, red shirt, get some matches, come back next year." Pat said that really fueled him and really pissed him off, and that's why he, you know, fought so hard. You know, why do you think it upset him so much?
Oh, just, you know, probably with Pat, just Bob. Bob was close to all of us, you know, close to our family, and here you have someone close to our family going, "Nah, you probably need a red shirt. You're not ready." Well, I'll show you, you know. You know, whether you're red-shirting or not, you don't want to. I'm sure Pat didn't want to hear, "I'm not ready. I can beat anyone," you know. Mm-hmm. I think that's what Pat was thinking, you know. And he did show us, you know. He was as competitive as anyone I've ever been around.
That's what Leroy says, yeah. Is that his toughness was just another level.
It was another level. That's why I said he was an overachiever. You know, he overachieved. I mean, when you look at him, you just go, you know. Well, anyone that wins four national championships being the first one, I mean, they're overachievers. But he overachieved in his freshman year. You know, he overachieved in his probably his sophomore and his junior year as well. You know, maybe his season that wasn't perfect, you know, was maybe towards the end of his senior year, you know. Maybe had some closer matches than I hoped, but so have we all been in situations where, you know, how many times you walk off the mat and you go, "I should have beat him worse," you know. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, I think Pat probably did that a little bit, but he also had a lot of pressure, you know, and he, sometimes you have to win ugly, and Pat knew how to win ugly.
It reminds me of you telling Bruce Burnett that I'm ready to win by one.
Yeah.
In 92.
That's right. You know, and just winning ugly. You know, yeah, I didn't have a great tournament. I didn't wrestle well, you know, but I knew I was going to have to win, you know, ugly. And I think for Pat, just, you know, dug deep and against some really good wrestlers, have had a lot of success. And like you said, just really tough.
And you look at the guys he beat, incredible list of, you know, national champions, and we can name them all. But the thing that really interests me about Pat is going into his last year, he assumed going into 93 that he was going to win his fourth, win it 4 in 4 years and be done. Then the NCAA sanctions come out, and he has to redshirt. And he says he actually almost went to Arizona State. What do you remember about that debate between transferring and staying?
Well, I knew he wasn't leaving. I knew my brother was trying to get him. So, I don't know what Leroy said about it, but I remember it. He wasn't going anywhere. He might have thought he was for a while, but we also didn't know a lot of things, right? And didn't know how the health of the program was going to be healthy. Is this, you know? And I think in the end, I worked really hard to reassure my mom, my dad, as well as, you know, people around us that we're going to be fine. We're going to come through this, and there's no need to, you know, something like that happening. Things fall apart quickly, you know, and it's a real dangerous time for your program, and for us it was dangerous, you know, and you know, I'm really loyal to those guys that stayed, you know, like Pat and, you know, Alan Freed, who actually gave up a year, you know. Those guys were real important for us to be able to bounce back immediately or take a hit for 6-7 years and trying to bring something back, you know. So those guys always need to be recognized as true cowboys. You know, those guys really, Pat and Alan Freed especially, really key time for us to keep them.
Yeah, and Alan Freed, he literally lost a year.
Lost a year.
That you don't get many of those.
No.
He told me it was worth it to be a part of a winning team, though, versus winning
at
Ohio
State. Yeah, and I hope it was worth it in the long run now, you know. I think, you know, I mean, we sometimes, the national championship team is, yeah, it is the goal, right? But I think, you know, 25 years later, 30 years later, your experiences and the things that you got to experience on those teams are as valuable as any as winning medals, as winning championships.
Yeah.
So, and I feel good about where Alan is and Pat is about Oklahoma State wrestling. You know, I feel really good about it because they did make a big commitment to us, bigger than any student athlete that can make. You know, you're giving up a year when you're ranked number 1-2 in the country.
Yeah,
you know, that's hard to do.
I mean, especially now when we're in the age of the selfish age, so to speak, they'd be gone in a second.
Yeah, and they don't think of anything bigger than them. There's several of them. I shouldn't say it's not all of them, but yeah. You know, these guys thought of something, you know. I mean, the only way you would stay is this is bigger than me, right?
Yeah.
Oklahoma State wrestling and where I'm at, it's bigger than me, you know. And when you start thinking you're bigger than that, then it's kind of when you don't really think things out very well, you know.
And at that time, you had just become the full-time head coach. And last time we met in September, we talked about the year you were co-head coach and what a disaster that was for you personally, not for the team. They still got second. But now you're the head coach full-time. You guys go like 3-8, 4-8, something like that. How humbling was that to go from having a parade thrown in your hometown in September to January? Mm-hmm. You can't win a dual meet.
Yeah. Well, that was the year that we couldn't go to Big 12 or NCAA championship. So, you know, we redshirted everyone and we put a dual meet team out there, you know, that a lot of people didn't think we should. You know, just go to tournaments. You're not wrestling the Big 12. You're not wrestling the national championship. There's part of me going, probably shouldn't have done it. But then there's a bunch of me going, yeah, because I saw some of the guys that got a chance to wrestle and what they did following it, you know. A couple of them ended up being long high school coaches, a lot of years they put in, you know, and it may have been that opportunity to compete that year. It wasn't a great team. I mean, when you think about it, it's you're putting, you know, we had four walk-ons that was starting that year. Five walk-ons that were starting that year. And somewhere mid-season, we had to go pull someone out of Eskimo Joe's that we knew wrestled, because we had our 25-pounder that got injured. We had to pull him out of Eskimo Joe's and train him up for a couple of weeks. And when they ended up starting for Oklahoma State in some dual meet somewhere. And he didn't get pinned or teched. I don't know what the tech was, Ben, or if there was a tech, but I just remember, I think it was just a major decision, and I don't think it mattered in the duel. I think we lost anyway. So.
It's like going into it, you knew it was going to be hard. And
well, you know, I could have made the easy decision and going, we're not wrestling duels. We're not going to put a hammer to Oklahoma State. We're not going to have the worst season in Oklahoma State's history. We're not going to do that. We're going to go and we're going to wrestle all these open tournaments, you know. And you know, if I had to do it all over again, we'd wrestle the dual meets.
Amen.
You know, and we would. You know, I'm glad there's guys that had an opportunity to compete, and some of them would never had that opportunity. And you know what? The crowds wasn't bad. I got some pushback from just losing a little bit, you know. You know, people assuming that you should win everything, even when you got half a team, you know. So anyway, it was hard. It wasn't easy.
But then the next year you guys are ranked 2. You go out to Penn State for the first duel of the year in Rec Hall, they're number 1. They had beaten Iowa a couple times, and you know, 94 was a year where it was really a toss-up for the team race. You guys go out there and beat Penn State at Rec Hall.
Mm-hmm.
You're number 1 in the nation. How were your nerves going into that duel at Rec Hall versus when you were an athlete?
Oh, you know, those early years, I think they were easier for me because I looked at things as the Olympics being the ultimate, you know, and here I am just wrestling a dual meet. I've come to appreciate that way more, you know. But I think coming out of the Olympics and doing some of the things, we can do this. This isn't tough, you know. We can go anywhere. And you know, I think I still had a little bit of that gamemanship that I left on the mat that I'm bringing into my coaching a little bit more. So there was some things I needed to appreciate more that I wish I would have, because I missed some time that I do regret as a coach, that I really enjoy and value more than ever now. So probably didn't have a lot of anxiety at all, you know, not like it is now, you know. And it's a way more funner for me now than it ever was then.
Why is that, you think?
Oh, I just, you know, just like I said, you know, I didn't know how long I was going to do it. I didn't know if it was a career for me. I didn't know a lot of things. I had a lot of choices to go do something else, and so I'm going to do it. But you know, I'm not too worried about it. You know, so just viewing it differently. You know, and which was good in some way, but definitely. Looking back, I regret that, you know, I didn't have the feeling I have now to really be able to embrace everything. You know, even winning the championship was a little bit of a good. We need to win them all the time. You know, you didn't realize how hard they are.
Some more gratitude.
You just didn't realize the competitiveness and how challenging they really are, you know. And so that's kind of how I viewed everything. And I think it was probably good for some of the student athletes, you know, not all of them.
How do you think you've changed as a coach from then versus the 94 season to now?
Outside, I value things way more. You know, I don't overlook things, you know. Just I don't assume that this stuff happens all the time. You know, I take the time for the special moments, you know. I take the time for the special performances and especially individually, you know, when you have guys that really had outstanding seasons, and I just don't assume that that's just going to happen all the time. And you know, slow down and, you know, smell the roses a little bit, you know, and just enjoy the moments and when there's really great, you know, great years, you know. You know, I've come to learn, really, you know, you can have a really great year as a team and not win a championship. You know, forever I thought that was impossible, you know. And so, you know, recognizing what you have and what they did as individuals, you know, judging them from their level. What's my team like? What's my talent level like? You know, and really that 94 team was overachievers, you know. They were overachievers to win that. Of course, Branch and some of those guys, three champions that year. Pat and Branch and Freed, mm-hmm. Right? So,
do you think you still win it without Branch winning it?
I don't think so.
Yeah, I don't think so. I just looked at the points, but
no, I don't think so. It took three champions.
Because Perler wrestled under the seed and
mm-hmm.
Okay. So, you know, obviously going into 94, you told me last time Pat was a massive focus for you, for the whole country going into it. And he said that Saturday before the Nationals, before the finals, team titles wrapped up. You guys had three in the finals. He said that you and him went to go see Red October.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
Yeah.
When you're doing something like that, are you talking about wrestling? What are you doing?
He wasn't in a good place, you know. I didn't think he was in a good place. The leading up to the Nationals, I didn't think he was in a good place. You know, I don't know if I told you the story on Branch and mm-hmm. him. Yeah, you know, I just didn't think he was in a great place. He struggled a little bit in some of his preliminary matches. And although the scores were a little bit, they were separated, I saw what was kind of building with him a little bit. And and again, he's getting ready to do something that you know, for at the time, you know, 70 years, almost 70 years, you know, I guess 70, would it be 70? Yeah, 70 years before, you know, yeah, it's probably a little less than that, but you're getting ready to do something that's never been done, and there's a lot of attention on it, and let's make sure you go out there and go for it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Let's leave nothing. I mean, you don't have to wrestle great and win this. I think I even said that to him. You know, we don't have to have the perfect match, okay? You're good enough to separate the score and win it when you have to win it, right? And preparing him to win by one, you know, because it wasn't going to be much more than that.
Yeah.
I don't know what the score finally ended up.
It's like 5-3?
Yeah, 5-3, like yeah. Yeah, I knew it wasn't going to be, you know. On another day, it might have been, you know. Tonight, You're going to have to go out and you're going to have to win one that's going to be tight. And you might have to get a takedown in the third to win it.
Man, it's so reminiscent to 92 to me. It's crazy.
Say that again.
It's reminiscent to your 92 season in a number of ways.
Yeah.
Speaking of that, Chuck White told a story last night that I would be doing the wrestling world justice if I didn't show you. that I just got to get your opinion on. Okay, so this is at the 92 trials in Pittsburgh, and all right, this is right after
this. Kind of look different.
Okay, so this is after the Fisher match.
The one I got beat.
Yeah.
You know, his skin looked paler or something for some reason, but you know, I didn't think too much about it, and then all of a sudden the match gets going, and you know, he ends up getting beat by Fisher, and it's kind of like. what the hell just happened?
How did you find him after that match?
We were driving to get something to eat between sessions, and he was sitting on the curb.
Yeah, on the curb.
On the curb, by himself. So we rolled down the window, you want to go eat? And he got in the car. And went with it. So think about this, he's getting ready to go wrestle his second match for the Olympic trials. We ate at Wendy's.
Wow. So when you saw him on the side of the road, was he in his singlet or his warm-ups?
He's in a warm-up.
So he leaves, he loses it, you know, he gets upset, he's out on the road, and you guys really didn't know where he was at that time?
No clue. Just by chance, ran into him.
So you get him in the car. What's he say in the car? Does he say anything? Is he crying?
No, he wasn't crying. He didn't say a lot in the car. And while we were eating lunch, he looks at me and is like, so what do you think? And I'm thinking, like, why are you asking me? All these gold medals, and why are you asking me what I think? And the only thing I told him, I said, you just don't got the eye of the tiger right now. That's the only difference I see.
You said that to him?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What did he say?
Huh? He just kind of looked at me and kind of what he mean. And I'm like, you know, your shots aren't 100%. You know, he didn't look like John, like where everything had 110% intent when he went. You know, he's kind of like 98, you know, and that's not who he is.
Heavy moments.
That's funny. I haven't seen that in. Or I haven't even talked about that, you know. That was about, I want to say I was probably about 3/4 of a mile from the facility when they pulled up next to me. And I was sitting on the curb, and I didn't know what I was doing out there. I just know I took off running and or walking, and you know, and then I was sitting on the curb, and you know, they pulled up, and my dad was with him too, and my mom was with him, you know, my dad and mom was, and they just picked me up, and I didn't know we went to Wendy's. I didn't really care probably then, but there wasn't much that got, you know. I don't remember him saying you don't look good. I mean, that wouldn't affected me. I knew I wasn't good right now, right then, you know. But that was unusual. That, you know, they just pull up and I get in and we go eat, you know, just somewhere down the road, you know. there wasn't much said. There wasn't. I mean, my dad knew where I was at for sure, you know. I wasn't in a good place, and I think, you know, when you think of that, when you say you're not in a good place, I think it just means, you know, things aren't clicking very well, you know, and you're going to have to make it a better place, and you make it a better place by winning matches how you have to, you know, and I, you know, it's just nice that you know that you can do that. I think it's real important, you know. And I don't think at that time in those trials I was punishing myself. I think, you know, saying I didn't work out enough. I wasn't, you know, I didn't stay focused enough on what I needed to do. I was coaching all season. I did some things I shouldn't have done. We know all that, right? I just think that just in life in general, there's days that they're not going to be good, so what are you going to do? You know, is history going to change because I don't feel good today? You know, to me, you know, those are the things that you want your children, you want your athletes, you want, you know, your friends to know about you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'll be there when it's tough. You know, whether that means you need a friend, whether that means, you know, you need a coach. And then one time in my career, it was about being tough when things aren't going well as an athlete.
It's such a hard time to to pull through, especially when the pressure's on you to already win. I mean, at that point, you said only gold will do, and when you get to gold, it's not even the same joy you had. You were wrestling because you felt like you had to, because you couldn't live with yourself to not be a six-time world champ. So that's a lot of pressure. What kind of conversations would you have with yourself? Like, what was your self-talk before match three of Fisher, or any big match for that matter, when you're in your head by yourself and you're talking to yourself?
Oh, I think you just the second match was a hard match, you know, and the third was hard. You know, you just know that they're going to be hard, you know, and you're just accepting it, mm-hmm. you know, I think, you know, getting beat that first match, I wasn't sure it was going to be that hard. Following that match, I knew they were going to be hard. Mm-hmm. So I needed that, you know. And Fisher, I'm going to tell you, man, there was something about him that I've never felt. I mean, I felt a better wrestler than I've ever felt from him. Mm-hmm. And even looking at his skills and some of the things he did in the match, I mean, he was definitely a different wrestler than I ever wrestled before. But I know what I was telling myself following that first loss. And even down a mile down the road, and they happened to just pull up next to me, I was probably, you know, helping them not feel so uncomfortable around me, you know. I knew where I was at. I knew what needed to take place in the next couple matches, and losing that first one, it prepared me for the next two. Mm. I knew they were going to be tough, and I knew I was going to have to scrap, and I was going to have to fight, and I wasn't going to feel things like I normally feel them. My leg lace wasn't there. My gut, you know, there was things that wasn't there that just, hey, they're not going to be there. You're going to have to scrap for each takedown, each score, and any turn will be a bonus. And by that time in my career, I was probably more known for my turns than anything, as much as low single leg, you know. So, they're satisfying moments. I mean, I wouldn't change anything. I just, mm-hmm. it's good to know, and it's good to know that you can bring a whole nother level when it looks a little bit ugly from what you're used to doing.
Yeah, and that was a 12-month period where, you know, Pat had some battles with Ray Miller, you had some battles with John Fisher, and then that summer, you go to the Olympics in 92, but before you do, I got to ask, how did the LA Times interview set up? Did he contact you?
I don't know.
That is one of the...
I don't know. You know, it's one of those... Yeah, I don't know. I think at that time, you know, they're looking at the three or four athletes... In the world, maybe even in this, just in the country, that are, you know, being a Sullivan Award winner. These are four. I mean, they probably did four or five interviews with four or five different athletes. And one that guy caught me on the wrong day. So I'll just say that. It wasn't a good day that day, and not that I knew it wasn't a good day that day, because I really don't know. I just know the things I said in that article, they're true, but I probably didn't word them like I wish I would have. It's like I don't give a damn right now, you know. Things aren't going well, you know. They wasn't going well.
Yeah.
You know, and I get asked about that article often.
Well, just the fact that you would do an interview before Barcelona, to me, says a lot about, well, one, it seems like, you know, LA Times is a huge paper, so you did it, but the interview itself is indicative of your mood at the time.
Yeah.
And that whole summer was pretty turbulent.
Yeah, it was turbulent.
And we talked about it last time. It reminds me a lot of when Michael Jordan was trying to win his, and that book, The Jordan Rules, came out, showing all the inner demons of Jordan. That article showed a lot of your inner demons at the time. And it's kind of, you know, for the whole world to see. So you go into Barcelona, and the one thing I didn't ask last time, when you wrestled Reynoso, was that the same day as the finals?
No. I don't know. I don't think it was. I think I came back the next day and won the finals. Yeah. Yeah, I think it was the next day.
Okay. Going into the Reynoso match, did you know the situation?
Yeah, unfortunately. Yeah, it was probably, I often think of that moment, you know, because it really, you know, there was something that there was something for me that was missing for a long time following the following that Olympic gold medal. There was something missing for a long time, you know. I wasn't really, you know, you know, you think of winning the gold medal, you know, you think of happiness, joy, you know. There was something missing for me, and it was that match. That match took a little bit of the gold from me. And I think because I just, you know, I did the minimum. But I will say this, you know, that I didn't need to know that, and I shouldn't have found out. You don't need to tell a five-time world champion that he needs to score 1 point. You know, you don't need to tell him that. You know, not somebody that historically scored a lot of points. And, you know, so you know, Reynoso was tough enough for me that I didn't need to know that. You know, so. It really affected how I thought when I realized I'm in a tough match. Mm-hmm. It really affected me. That's what affected me more than anything in that match is, when things get really tough, your options are find a way to win, score the points when you get to do this. You know, your mind's operating that way if you're a competitor, but when you know you can opt out, that's not healthy. And so when things got really tough in that match, all I could think of was a point. You know, and I wouldn't think about winning.
Especially since
I was thinking about getting that point.
Yeah. I mean, you had already had such a history with Reynoso anyway. We knew it was going to be a conflicting styles matchup. And I've seen you beat him 15-2. I've seen you beat him by one. You know, so it's that's a really interesting cat to watch those matches with you and him.
Yeah, there was a conflict of style between he and I. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was just... just odd. He felt odd to me. You know, and when I say odd, there was guys that beat him pretty consistently at my weight that I'd tech fall, you know. But for me, it was a conflict. There was a real conflict. So I didn't need anything. I don't know why anyone would tell me that. You know, I didn't need any. I needed to go into that match, and I needed to focus on this is a battle match. You know, I had a 2-1 match or 3-1 or 3-2 with the North Korean, you know. I think it was in earlier rounds. It was tough. He was a tough kid. I struggled all summer, right? I need everything I have. I don't need some excuse to go run to, mm-hmm. you know. And for that reason, you know, it's just it didn't sit with me for a long time very well. When I say a long time, I'm talking maybe, you know, somewhere around 2008, 10, I start to appreciate that gold medal.
That's a long time.
Yeah. But, you know, early that summer when I realized, you know, coming off the illness, we talked about that illness a little bit I had that really set me back, and I didn't think it did. And once I got into really training, I realized it affected my endurance as well as my health. But I made a commitment, and I don't know if I said this to you, but I remember making a commitment that I'm going to go 36-0, undefeated in world and Olympic competition. And that was my goal. It wasn't winning the Olympic gold medal. It wasn't trying to make the team. It's here, I need to have something that's going to, that's bigger than the Olympic gold medal. I need something, because another medal may not do it for me where I'm at, you know. And so I really made that commitment that that's what I want to be known for, is that in world and Olympic competition, John Smith went 36-0 against the best wrestlers in the world. That was what I had my sights set on. It really wasn't to win a gold medal, and those sights were set before Fisher's matches. You know, this is part of the process for me to be able to do this. You know, so it kind of took that pressure off of maybe, you know, some of the things I'd said earlier. You know, is there's only one medal I can win, you know, and maybe saying some of those things, I realized I need something bigger than this. Dude, you've not put enough pressure on yourself by saying that, you know.
Was that after 88 when you made that goal, or before 88?
No, this I made my last year. You know, when I got back and I got, you know, season ended at Oklahoma State, and I realized I'm in a little bit of trouble. You know, I made it my last year that I want to go 36-0, you know, or undefeated. Mm-hmm. You know, it would have been 36-0.
Yeah.
I want to go undefeated in world and Olympic competition, you know. So losing that match kind of set me back a little bit. And I think for several years, you know, I just didn't, I'm glad I was able to realize, you know, over time, realize some things that, John, you know, you darn sure wouldn't want to be raising your kids thinking this way, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that's a lot.
You might do some real, you know, and just you get older and you realize that, you know, maybe, you know, now I look at it a little bit differently. You know, I'm proud of them. I'm proud that, you know, that I was able to finish my career winning.
We talked about this last time. I believe that greatness and madness are next door neighbors, and they borrow each other's ingredients, right? So you're real close to being crazy or great, and sometimes at the end it gets real blurry. And you talk about someone who's a six-time world champ not being able to let something go until 2008. That shows you how far that spectrum can go.
Yeah, no, it's, you know, well, and just, you know, you think of just competitors in general in all sports. You know, there's a lot of wrestlers that walk away from NCAA championship. It takes them forever to get back.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, they just disappear, mm-hmm. you know, because of poor performance, what they may think, you know? Let me share with any of you out there that are feeling that, it's a waste of time. And I wasted a lot of time from 1992 probably to 2008, you know, and probably said some silly stuff that is selfish and is immature, and it's not healthy, right? I mean, and so, you know, because of that experience now for the last 10, 12 years, I always tell my guys, no regrets, man. We got to be doing this with no regrets, you know, and we're going to have enough real regrets in our life that's not around the sport, you know, that you're going to have to deal with and get better at. And that may be, you know, your marriage. It may be raising a child. You know, it may be your personality in the workforce, whatever, right? And so let me tell you, man, just you got to walk from things, you know. And I've learned that. You know, you learn that as a coach here, you know. You know, not winning the championship now, and you know, 12 years. You know, are you going to regret every season when you don't win, or you know, how is your personality going to be? You know, are you going to be able to maintain a good personality as you're going through this experience? So, anyway, it is a waste of time. I wasted a lot of years looking at things. Probably the way I shouldn't have after I was finished.
Well, the one thing I wanted to jump back,
I didn't think it hurt anything, though.
Okay.
Other than myself.
But that's like a gnawing that you could just be driving down the road in the middle of summer and all of a sudden it hits and it could ruin the next 4 hours of your day. It's annoying, you know?
Yeah.
It sucks. But there was a time I wanted to go back to that we hit on the very first time in August. You had a loss to Jim Jordan. You really processed that the right way. You had some dialogue with yourself. Am I ready? Am I going to make it? You know, I've been here 3 years now. I haven't won. So what was your goal going into the redshirt year?
Make an Olympic team. Yeah, make a world team, actually. A little bit of me was really concerned that I wasn't good enough. I think part of that wanting a redshirt, too, was knowing that I wasn't good enough. You know, I think the way he beat me, and I've said it to you, you know, he was going to beat me that day. He was going to beat me a week from now, and he's probably going to beat me a month from now. You know, I wasn't going to beat that guy. You know, even though you know, I found a way earlier in the season, but. I just felt like I was overmatched. I was outmatched, you know. And I think a little bit of that was a hangover as going into that year. You know, Coach C didn't want me to redshirt, but I really felt like there was a level of maturity that I needed. You know, and maybe a little bit nervous that it was all going too fast. Hmm. You know, I wrestled as a true freshman. I wrestled my sophomore year. You know, and a little bit of, it's going too fast. I'm about done here. You know, and I wasn't, you know, I need to pull back a little bit. And, you know, I don't know if I'm ready to go win a national championship going into my junior year, you know.
Wow.
I probably wasn't. You know, if I didn't take that redshirt, I'm not sure I would have won. I'm not sure I would have developed some of the skills I developed. I wasn't sure that empty feeling of the first time in your life I'm not out on the mat wrestling. Instead, I'm in the stands. You know, I remember feeling that way. I'm sitting in the stands and I'm like, you know, nobody's noticing me or, you know, I mean, I should be out there wrestling. You know, and all of a sudden, there's a real feeling of I'm a wrestler. I need this sport.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so the red shirt was definitely the key to me.
What happened in that black box of 3 months where you're drilling three times a day, you're working out with Jerry? What was the change?
Just maturity. You know, you realize what you want. You know, we often talk about the things we want to do, you know, and the things that we want to accomplish. But in the end, how bad do you want them? How bad do you want these things? Well, I hit a time in my life where I'd lost the national championship the year before. I walked off the mat knowing that I couldn't beat the guy now or probably in a month from now. I'm not competing for my school. First time in my history that I'm not competing in a year. And all that kind of just stirred me up to going, was worried about time. This is your time.
Mm-hmm.
So if it doesn't happen, you know, you're 2 years away from Olympics. You only have two more years of college left. So for me, it was just a matter of time. And I think that you see it in people. I see it in some of my student athletes, you know, when they hit their junior year. Maybe I see a whole different athlete, you know. For me, I was a different athlete, but there was a level of urgency to win that I wasn't going to be denied somehow. I mean, all of a sudden, I had an attitude that, and then I backed it up with a work ethic that between the two, it was turned into a lot of medals. a lot of gold medals.
Yeah, and at that time, you talk about you're doing the physical work, you're emotionally ready, but you're also doing the mental work. So I've heard you talk about when you were really deep into it, you would have these invisible wrestlers appear in your head.
Yeah.
What did you mean by that? And how often would you visualize?
I visualized a lot, man, you know, especially routine things that you want to do and just seeing yourself hitting leg laces, gut wrenches, low singles, seeing yourself score, and seeing some things that sometimes you don't want, you know. In 92, I remember going back to my room after Reynoso, and I think it was that evening. I'm almost positive I wrestled Reynoso the day before, but and if I didn't, I went back and took a nap after I got beat and came back that night, or I'm sure it was the next day I wrestled. But I remember waking up from the nap or from a long night of sleep, and I remember dreaming, had this dream that I got beat in the finals. And I remember waking up and it feeling as real as anything I've ever felt in my entire life. This is a true story, and I've told a few people this.
I've never heard this one.
And I just remember waking up, you know, and feeling that as real. And I didn't know at the time, but I knew that something felt odd, you know. It's like, did I lose? Did I lose the match? You know, and I'm sitting there and I'm thinking and I go down and I'm taking a walk and I'm like, no, I got the match today. I got the match today. And I read the newspaper. They had a newspaper that was that they put out for all the athletes every day in the Olympic Village, a U.S. newspaper. And I remember opening up and pulling that back to wrestling. No, I wrestled today. I was relieved. I just felt relieved. And I think that moment probably really helped me perform at a high level. It was just like a second chance here. You know, that's crazy. You know, and I don't, I mean, I just remember that it just felt so real to me, but there was something was telling me, you had a poor dream, you know. I just remember, though, it was a sense of relief. It was like, no, you haven't wrestled for the gold medal yet, you know. And there was just it was kind of like, I get a second chance here, you know. I lost 8 hours ago, you know, somewhere. I don't know why I got off on that.
Well, I was just asking about the invisible head wrestlers, and that dream and the visualization came up. Did you have that, though, these, like, kind of faceless wrestlers in your head? Like, mm-hmm. when you were really getting down with the low single and you were, like, completely isolated and you were really, like an 89-90 where you're in the zone?
Yeah. I was drilling all the time. Going through routines of just with, you know, partners. All I had was a bunch of legs that I was shooting at, you know. And just having a lot of success, you know. I think anytime you're visualizing, you know, it's real important that you have success. Some people struggle having success mm-hmm. when they're visualizing. I mean, I dominated everyone.
You know, it is hard to let those negative thoughts
I kicked everyone's ass, even Fadzaev's and some of those guys that, you know, you're like, I'd like to wrestle him, you know. Well, I did. I teched him like 40 times.
Oh, my God.
And the one guy I always struggled with because he was just, you know, that was around him, it was Nate Carr, you know, and he was a weight above me, but he was always powerful and, you know, we'd work out some. Man, I whipped him a lot too. So he was always, in practice, he was always the really challenged, you know, ultimately challenged me, you know. And I always said to myself, I need to be whipping him. Well, the only place I ever whipped him was the bazaar. I never whipped him in practice.
Royce was telling a story about that in 90 when you guys went to Tokyo for the Worlds. You were wrestling Nate Carr, and, you know, he was big for the weight.
Yeah.
And he said you guys would go, and you'd be messing around, and then something would get serious, and you'd grab your headgear, you go, all right, what the hell, or what the crap, and like you'd slam, and you're like, we're going for real now, and you guys would just go at it for like 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Classic.
He was tough.
Oh, my God. Just an incredible athlete. Randy said that he... That's the one guy he never even came close to taking out in practice, Randy Lewis. Said whenever he wrestled Nate Carr, it wasn't even close. And he was only a weight up.
You know, yeah. He was good. Yeah. And he was big, you know. And I didn't very often move up and wrestle guys that were bigger, even in practice. You know, I was real – I didn't need to feel that, you know, that challenge all the time, you know, but for some reason with Nate, I needed to fill it a little bit more, and I think we were a little thin on workout partners that year, and it, we had to count on each other a lot leading up to that world championship, you know, and I will tell you this, that was probably my greatest performance that I had in my career was in Tokyo.
Oh, you were lights out. I have a highlight clip here.
Yeah, I mean, you know, so that was a, you know, when you think that you didn't have a lot of partners and all of a sudden, you know, you're limited, you'd think, how can you be limited prior to the World Championships? Well, I don't know, you know, but sometimes it forces you to a, you know, a different focus that gives you no reasons to have excuses, you know.
How would the low single evolve in 90 from when you started it?
Oh, it was full force on display, you know. I think after that year in 91, I really started to feel a lot of development on some of the finishes, you know. So, you know, it evolved, you know, and even today, you know, there's a lot of things that people do that that I never did, you know. You know, it's one of those tactics, the low single legs is one of those tactics in matches that you can't really prepare for. And I always knew that. Like, you know, okay, I need to beat somebody that's got a 2-on-1 to my right arm, you know. I need to beat somebody that ties up with the right hand to the head and inside ties with his left hand. That's what I got to be, you know. I think you always have a, if you have an athlete, you always have a chance to help that athlete stop something, like an inside tie to the head, like a 2-on-1. I mean, I always told guys, you know, if somebody's going to come out and try to 2-on-1 me and I get beat, I deserve to get beat. if you're getting 2-on-1, you know, then you're reaching, you're doing just some terrible things to be getting, you know, getting pulled into 2-on-1, you know. But there's not a lot of tactics to stopping that low single leg, you know. And one of the reasons why is, you know, if you can't touch me, you can't stop anything, you know. So that's one thing I always knew was they can do all the work they want. But, you know, when you're just trying to keep me off your legs, I'm doing those practices every day.
With good guys.
With good guys.
Yeah.
You know, keep me off your legs. That's, you go back to what we were saying about Pat, you know.
Yeah.
And so in my mind, I always thought that, like, it don't matter what they're doing back at home. All they're trying to do is nothing. Do nothing. That's how we got to stop him. We got to do nothing. Got to, you know, drop on a knee or, you know.
Best way to stop it is really through a scramble once you get in, and that really hadn't developed at that point because your finishes were so prolific.
Yeah.
I mean, you know what I mean?
Yeah. The scrambles today, how you know, that's really a neat, that should be a podcast for you one day, is how much more exciting folk style got when scramblings really came in and the and you know, the ability to scramble and some of this just fascinating things that some of these athletes did for the last 10 years, you know. Mm-hmm. None of that was in my time. And, of course, it's limited because you can't expose your back.
True.
You know, some of these guys are dropping on their back, pulling a foot over, crawling up between the legs, and they're giving up point after point, you know.
Right.
So it's a little bit different, yeah.
Yeah. Well, the one thing I want to ask you about, Coach, and we'll wrap up in 5 minutes here. I want to do a section on your endorsements because you were the first guy to have your own instructional tape, How Low Can You Go,
mm-hmm.
right? We had How Low Can You Go 2, but How Low Can You Go 1 came out. I guess my question is, who approached you for that and how did that get going?
Dave Bennett. You know Dave?
Uh-uh.
Dave Bennett was actually an eye doctor out of Washington. Ended up, he was a good coach. He coached, you know, as a hobby when he was practicing. He was in Kennewick, Washington. I'd go up there every year and do him a clinic, and we'd have about 15 kids. He had a ranch outside of town, and he had about 15 kids I'd come and coach every year and generate a little income. Well, he's the one that gave me the idea that you should be doing a videotape. And I said, well, if you do it, I'll do it, you know. And it started there. And Dave did a lot of videotapes, probably before anyone did. Mm-hmm. He ended up working at USA Wrestling. He's been around for a long time, been very instrumental in a lot of the early tapes and a lot of the early, some of the great matches, you know, that he has on tape. He's got a library of tapes that's phenomenal.
Wow.
I mean, if you ever want to go see something or see some matches that you haven't seen, he's got them. And I'm talking about the dual meets back then, all of them.
The Team USA Russia ones?
Yeah, all of
them. Huge.
Yeah. And so he's done a great service for wrestling because he preserved a lot of things that that really mean a lot to people. So, he started it and it was a hit for me and it was exciting, you know, just to have something out there that could generate a little more income for you.
How'd you come up with the name?
I think Dave Bennett came up with it.
Wow.
Yeah. I think he was real interested in me and he took, you know, he allowed me to train there at his place there in Washington while we were doing the camp, and I'd always bring a couple guys up and I'd have training partners and we'd be teaching all day, and in between we would be doing workouts, and it'd be a 16-hour day, but you know, it was a great opportunity for us to make extra money. Yeah.
And at the same time, you're doing a bunch of camps. How many camps were you doing at the peak in the 80s?
Not as many as you think, you know, because you know, at the beginning of that, it was exciting. You know, towards the end of my career, it was draining. So, you know, I think, you know, going out and early on, you know, I was running hard, man. But by running hard, I was also, body was getting stronger and tougher and, you know, but it was just exciting. I just remember those earlier years, it was exciting going to, you know, you walk into 400 kids and their eyes are on you and you're like, wow, you know, what did I do? You know, well, you won a world championship, John. And probably even after my first Olympics, you know, it was just real exciting to me. And there was a level of me that was just like, I'm making some real money, you know, and I never had money, you know. And I think anytime you're making some money, real money, it's exciting. You know, it's, you know, you just don't want to make the wrong mistakes, take the wrong steps, you know. And I did that, you know. And I think after I got back after 88, my time I got real stingy with it after that loss in Cuba. You know, I got real stingy and going, what are you doing here? What are we going to do here? And then I'd do maybe a few a year, and I really backed way off of it because...
That's a grind.
Well, it was a grind, and it's hard. You know, you're getting offered some money that's just like, you know, that's a real difference. You know, I can buy more land. You know,
more cattle.
Yeah, and but it ended it ended in Cuba.
So this is
I backed way off.
This is there at the same time. This is the last interview I'll show you. I found this on a 1990 World Cup clip, and they interview you, and this is where I'm like, oh, there's something that happened where the money and all the distractions got to a point where you couldn't take it anymore.
Yeah.
I set a goal every day just to get up and work out, you know, and to train hard. I've got to stay motivated every day. For me to continue wrestling, it's daily goals. It's not something to set a goal to be a world champion in 1991. It's a goal to concentrate on my skills, concentrate on my conditioning, because you have a tendency now, I'm feeling, and no one can explain this to me because no one's been where I've been. It's tough to get motivated now, to get up every day like you've been doing in the past, to train as hard as you've always trained, to win a world champion, because you've already won one. That don't mean I don't love the sport and I want to retire. I want to wrestle. I don't want to train as hard.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
What a moment in time. It's like a time capsule.
Yeah.
Just all that kind of coming to a head. Because that was right before, right
well,
after.
Well, it's just, what are you going to do, you know? You think about it, and, you know, and it never was about the money for me. You know, I would say early on in my career, it was just nice making some money, you know? I mean, nothing these guys make today, you know? But, I mean, $500 was just like, what? You know, $500 would take care of my whole month. You know,
yeah.
You know, and you're gonna give me this come for a weekend, you know, you know, just like, you know, that kind of excitement, you know. But I knew real quickly that the two didn't mix for me. You know, I did a lot better when I'm poor than I do when I have money.
Yeah.
You know, so. And you're going to lose those years, right? I mean, so many people lose the years because they're chasing something that really doesn't matter. You know, just go win, and you're going to get whatever you want. The things that you want, you're going to eventually get them. And you know, hopefully it's not as simple as money, but, you know, it's the things you truly want, and that's to be satisfied. I'm proud of my career. I'm proud of my, you know, I'm proud of my teams. I'm proud of my coaching, you know. In the end, you're going to get everything you want, you know. And for me, you know, I had to back off because it was just, it was too much, you know. Too many things were happening, and too much responsibility goes into, you know, back then to make money as a wrestler, there was too many responsibilities you had to have extra to make money. Now, these guys, you know, don't have to. They go win, and it's a good. They got great opportunities. Not that I didn't.
Yeah.
It was just different.
Name of the podcast, Wrestling Changed My Life. I've been waiting to ask you this since the first time I interviewed you. How did wrestling change your life? Then we'll cut everything.
Well, it's changed my life in so many ways. I mean, I don't even know where to start with that. You know, growing up in a family of 10, you know, wrestling changed my life growing up from being in a family of 10, you know. You know, just, you know, I mean, to coaching, wrestling's changed my life, you know, as a coach, as a parent. I mean, it's too, you can't narrow me down to one thing, you know. It's just like, it's humbled me throughout my career, like anything that I've needed, right? From the time I started, it's humbled me, you know, and recognize there's this sport can put you to your knees if you're not careful, you know. You know, so if I really had to say one particular thing that's changed my life, I just have to say this, you know, it gave me every value of how to set goals. Wrestling's taught me how to set a goal and how to go after it. You know, and whether that is raising your children, having a relationship with your wife, having a relationship with your friends, you set these goals, some things throughout every day that have nothing to do that's related with wrestling. And I attack it like I did as a wrestler. You know, I'm setting a goal and I'm going to accomplish this. I'm going to find a way to accomplish it. And when you find ways to accomplish it, you're going to have to be humble. You're going to have to be respectful. You're going to have to honor people, respect people. You're going to have to go through all those characteristics to, you know, just to accomplish a goal. And so, for me, you know, I've learned how to set goals through the sport and accomplishment that has nothing to do with wrestling.
Love it.
Yeah.
Coach, thank you, sir.
You bet.
You were in rare form today. Cool. It was awesome.
Hey guys, if you want to help us spread the word, please rate the episode and share it with your friends. The Smiths was written and directed by Ryan Warner. Executive producers include USA Wrestling and the National Wrestling Hall of Fame. A special thank you to the entire Smith family, Rich Bender and Leroy Smith.
Etched in Stone is an exclusive production of the National Wrestling Hall of Fame and USA Wrestling. Download your free souvenir book of any of the Etched in Stone stories produced at nwhof.org. The storybook includes the written story and is filled with pictures and videos of their live matches. And while you're on the website, take a deeper dive into the profiles of the 179 distinguished members inducted into the National Wrestling Hall of Fame.